final faculty member I chatted with for this program was Dr. Stephen Rosen, whom I met with for a review of an uncommon cancer that has recently been the subject of considerable research and the approval of two new agents. To begin, Dr. Rosen provided a perspective on the disease or diseases.
Most oncologists are fairly comfortable with the spectrum of B-cell lymphomas, the more common, in particular in the United States. The T-cell disorders make up definitely less than 20%. In my own personal experience, probably close to 10% of the lymphomas that we contend with. The patients who have cutaneous lymphomas are a subset of those T-cells. There are only about 2,000 newly diagnosed patients with cutaneous T-cell lymphomas a year in the country. However, the patients often live for many years, so the prevalence is more in the range of 30 to 40,000 individuals. And the patients with the cutaneous T-cell lymphomas, there's usually a spectrum of treatment approaches that they'll receive over the course of the life expectancy. Focusing first on the cutaneous T-cell lymphomas, the most common is mycosis fungoides. Stepping back a moment, the T-cell lymphomas of the skin make up 80% of skin lymphomas. The other 20% are B-cell. So of that 80%, about half are mycosis fungoides and its variants. The one variant is the follicular mycosis fungoides, which carries a slightly worse prognosis, though it's rare, a worse prognosis than typical mycosis fungoides. Then you have the CD30 positive lymphoproliferative disorders. That's lymphomatoid papillosis and the anaplastic large cell. They resemble each other in every way, shape, and form, and so it can be very difficult to distinguish the two entities. And in fact, sometimes you'll think you're dealing with an anaplastic large cell and it'll spontaneously regress like lymphomatoid papillosis. That group of diseases is distinct when it presents in the skin than when it presents systemically. In the skin, we usually use just tumor-directed therapy or just observation. Patients do well. The next group is the paniculitic T-cell lymphomas, and they tend to have a alpha-beta receptor rearrangement, tend again to fall into the indolent category, though the mortality at 5 years is more than you would see with mycosis fungoides. And then there's a very small subset of CD4-positive T-cell lymphomas that present exclusively in the skin. Then there's the aggressive variety. The Sézary syndrome is the most best known of those entities, with probably a 5-year survival that's less than 50%. Maybe if you talk about the full-blown syndrome of exfoliative erythroderma, high circulating counts, lymphadenopathy, maybe closer to 25 to 30%. So still a difficult disease to manage. And then you have the gamma delta T-cell lymphomas that can present in the skin, highly aggressive, terrible prognosis. There's also natural killer cell lymphomas that can present in the skin, and a rare dendritic type of malignancy that was thought to be in the natural killer T-cell family, but now clearly known to be dendritic in nature, that's almost like a leukemia in its behavior. So this is a very interesting spectrum of diseases. When you then switch to the systemic T-cell lymphomas, the most common is the peripheral T-cell lymphoma, not otherwise specified. That's probably followed by the angioimmunoblastic lymphomas, which often present with systemic symptoms, that can present with autoimmune phenomena as well. Then you have the anaplastic large cell that are either ALK, which is the anaplastic lymphoma kinase, ALK positive or ALK negative. The ALK positive tend to present in younger individuals, tend to have actually fairly high cure rates with just traditional systemic chemotherapy. The other entities in the systemic are the natural killer cell lymphomas, very common in Southeast Asia. And the last major entity is the HTLV-1, adult T-cell leukemia lymphomas, which again are endemic to portions of Asia like the Kyushu province, also seen in the Caribbean, parts of Africa, less common in the United States unless individuals migrate from those areas. I probably left one or two out, but it's a broad spectrum.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the new research in this area, new agents, new strategies that are being looked at?
So within the last few months, two new agents have been approved for treatment of peripheral T-cell lymphomas, which also have activity against mycosis fungoides and Sézary syndrome. They're new in the sense that they're active, but they're not new in the sense that their mechanism of action is distinct from previously approved drugs that are used in this area. So one is pralatrexate. This is an anti-fol. It has a higher affinity than methotrexate for the folate carrier and appears to be more potent than methotrexate in vitro. And there's evidence from the original trials that some patients who appeared to not respond to methotrexate or had a brief response to methotrexate still responded to pralatrexate. The other new drug is dexipeptide, and this is a histone deacetylase inhibitor. There had been a previous histone deacetylase inhibitor approved for mycosis fungoides and Sézary syndrome, vorinostat. That's an oral agent. This particular agent, romidepsin, is intravenous.
And just sticking on that one question, what do we know about the comparison of those two agents?
There is no head-to-head comparison. Both seem to have similar activity in the sense that maybe a third of patients treated who have been heavily pretreated with other agents seem to have significant responses, and some are durable.
What about other agents that have been used? How do they compare with some of the newer ones? One is Diflatox.
So there's a whole spectrum of agents that have been approved for the cutaneous T-cell lymphomas. In fact, it's been quite gratifying to see that this rare disease has resulted in a number of agents making their way to the clinic that have helped patients not just with this disease but others, one of which is denileukin diftatox. The trade name is Ontak. This is a recombinant toxin. I believe it was approved over a decade ago. It combines the interleukin 2 molecule with the diphtheria toxin. It's injected intravenously, binds to cells that express the high or intermediate affinity interleukin 2 receptor, which allows for internalization. Then it affects protein synthesis through the diphtheria toxin and can be quite effective. It's, again, about a third of the patients treated seem to respond. What's interesting is that the response rates are not that different whether you're expressing CD25, which is one of the three peptides that's part of the interleukin 2 receptor, or if you're not expressing CD25. And the reason for that is that you can express the other two peptides and still get internalization and killing. And in some instances, you can express only the CD25 peptide and you won't get internalization. So that's one of the complicated aspects of the use of that particular agent.
Any other agents that are utilized? What about targretin?
So targretin is a rexinoid, rexinoid being related to the vitamin A family, and rexinoids are slightly different in their structure than retinoids. Retinoids are also used in this disease, but targretin, which is also known as bexarotene, is an oral agent. It's very effective, has higher response rates than had been recorded with the other agents that we've been discussing, though there's not been a direct comparison, and the patient populations may be different. Extremely well tolerated by patients in terms of how they feel when they're taking the medication, but there are two issues that we contend with. One, fairly simple, patients develop a central hypothyroidism and they require Synthroid. The second, a little bit more complicated, is a hypolipidemia. Can be both triglycerides and hypercholesterolemia, can be quite significant, requires medications to control. And we've had two ischemic events at Northwestern in spite of, I think, good control of the lipids while using targretin. It's made us tend to use it at a lower dose, often in combination with light therapy.
What about the side effects and toxicity with the other agents you mentioned, pralatrexate, HTAC inhibitors, and Diflatox?
Starting with pralatrexate, and I've had limited experience with the two new agents, what's reported is thrombocytopenia and, probably more disturbing to patients, mucositis. And that's going to be the challenge in this patient population because it's a chronic disease and patients are already suffering from the cosmetic consequences of the cutaneous lymphoma. And so mucositis adds a burden. Using folic acid and B12, it appears that you can reduce that complication, but it's still an issue. The romidepsin or dexpeptide. That particular agent, my understanding, it's fatigue, malaise, some nausea with administration, and transient cytopenias. There had been a concern that there could be significant cardiac toxicity, in particular due to QT prolongation, but in the clinical trials in the lymphoma patients, that has not appeared to be a major problem. The Denileukin Diftatox, or again, ONTACT, there the major problem is peripheral edema. There's a vascular leak syndrome that can occur. In addition, you get liver function enzyme abnormalities that are usually transient. Some patients will get fatigue and malaise. Turns out that when you concurrently administer steroids, you can truly ameliorate those symptoms. Even though the drug has been around for a decade, the optimal way of delivering it remains open to debate. With this particular agent, patients often will have a harder time during the first cycles of therapy than if they're fortunate enough to respond and getting more treatment.
Maybe you can talk a little bit about sort of the algorithm. Obviously, each patient is individual for cutaneous T-cell and peripheral T-cell in terms of, in general, kind of where the patients track down through.
Sure. So with so many different entities, the approach is truly disease-specific and in part based on the comorbidities the patient has in their age. If we start with patients with mycosis fungoides, the first issue is what is the stage? They can range from limited patch plaque disease, which is called stage 1A, where the median survival is not very different than the general population, and it's usually just treating for cosmetic consequences, and we'll often use topical agents such as steroids, nitrogen mustard. We may use light therapy. If it's a patch and not a plaque, we'll use ultraviolet B light. If it's thicker, we may use PUVA therapy, where patient ingests the sorolin compound and is then exposed to UVA light. Sometimes, depending on the extent of the disease and the thickness of the lesions, we may combine it with systemic treatments such as interferon, which is the most effective systemic therapy for the disease, which is given as a subcutaneous injection, or with targretin. In our case, we tend to use lower doses. This is also a disease that after the initial therapy, if it doesn't work, so Linza is a consideration. And radiation therapy has been used for decades, either total body electron beam, which we've shied away from, occasionally total body irradiation at low doses, but most commonly spot radiation. There's also topical targretin, which can be used for isolated lesions. It usually causes some inflammation before you get regression. And then for the patients who have more of the Sézary presentation, the leukemic form, there, in addition to the treatment approaches I mentioned, Campath has significant activity. Campath, also the generic name would be alemtuzumab. We use it subcutaneously. We've had some wonderful durable responses with that. Or the use of photopheresis, where you actually leukapherese the patient. The malignant cells are exposed to a sorolin compound outside the body, treated with ultraviolet light, reinfused into the patient, and theoretically sets up an immune response. This is usually administered as a two-day treatment every 2 weeks until response, and then usually on a monthly basis. For patients who have the CD30-positive cutaneous lymphomas, their observation is often indicated unless there's a cosmetic problem. And then we'll often use single-agent methotrexate or ultraviolet light or steroid injection for isolated lesions. If it turns out it's a true anaplastic large cell that progresses systemically, then you're using systemic chemotherapy. For some of the patients with the CD30-positive malignancies presenting in the skin, spot radiation is the appropriate treatment. For the alpha-beta receptor paniculitic T-cell lymphoma, there's a lot of debate about how to best treat these patients, but in general, steroids or single-agent chemotherapy, methotrexate and chlorambucil have been used predominantly in Europe, and we reserve aggressive systemic therapy for those patients where the disease progresses and is clearly not going to be controlled with the simpler remedy. For the patients with the aggressive skin lymphomas like the gamma delta, there it's combination chemotherapy, and even that is only effective for a brief period, and we're often thinking of allogeneic transplant from day one. Then when you move to the systemic T cells, again, it's a complicated group. The traditional therapy for most of those has been just CHOP, outside of, say, the HTLV-1 lymphomas. Having said that, the results have been inadequate. The cure rates are much lower than when you see with B-cell lymphomas. So for each of the entities, investigators are exploring other options. The options range from adding CAMPATH to CHOP to adding ONTAC to CHOP to doing autologous transplant as an early option for those that clearly have, based on the prognostic indices, a poor prognosis. The only group that I think there's a comfort level using CHOP alone is the CD30 positive anaplastic large cells that are also ALK positive. And that's, again, as I mentioned earlier, seen in a younger group of patients and tends to have a high remission rate and cure rate.
What about the issue of executing clinical research in this patient population? So few patients. What's the strategy been?
So for the cutaneous lymphomas, it actually has worked well, and that's why so many agents have been approved. It turns out the investigators in the field are all close friends, tend to collaborate, have participated in investigations that have led to the approval of all the agents we've discussed. In part, it's been a little bit easier to get approval for these agents than in other diseases because of the cosmetic component. And so if you have a high response rate, a durable response, the FDA understands the benefit to the patient in contrast to certain diseases where you have to compare to another agent and show superiority in order to get an approval. For the peripheral T-cell lymphomas, it's been a real challenge in the United States because the diseases are uncommon. And if you're going to be able to put together appropriate trials, it's going to have to go through the cooperative groups. Having said that, Owen O'Connor has been successful at driving the development of pralatrexate. And then the group at the NCI, their work led to the approval of romidepsin.
Let's talk about some of your patients that you brought here to talk about, maybe beginning with a 60-year-old man with Sézary syndrome.
Yes, so this gentleman was diagnosed in 1997. He comes from Michigan, a laborer who had been in excellent health prior to his original diagnosis. As is often the case, he went through multiple different treatments, some giving somewhat durable remissions, others very short-lived, including PUV interferon, which has been our standard since the mid-80s, where we've had the best results. It's actually an interesting story. There was a patient who was living in Chicago who went to Arizona for a long weekend while on interferon and was wearing a cutoff T-shirt, and everywhere that there was sun exposure, there were dramatic responses, and that's when we started incorporating the light therapy with interferon. So this gentleman then had photopheresis treatment. He went on bexarotene.
How did he do on that?
The photopheresis, no appreciable benefit. There was some reduction in counts, but no appreciable benefit. The bexarotene, a short-lived but meaningful response. No benefit to the denileukin diftatox. Had some benefit to gemcitabine. He then went on our Revlimid trial. Revlimid, as you know, is approved for myeloma and myelodysplastic syndromes. On Revlimid, which is a pill, which is wonderful, he had an initial flare, which has also been seen in chronic lymphocytic leukemia. Very interesting initial flare. And then he had some reduction. And he actually is one of the patients, when I give Revlimid talks, I show his before and after photos. But again, the response was short-lived. Had a very meaningful response to alemtuzumab, but again progressed. And in October of 2006, had a matched sibling mini allo transplant. Jayesh Mehta is his transplant physician, and he uses melphalan as the conditioning regimen. He had grade 2 acute graft versus host disease and currently has some very mild chronic graft versus host disease, mainly oral mucosa, but he remains in a complete remission, doing beautifully, and is only on 5 milligrams of prednisone as his sole medication.
What do you see for him in the future?
I hope cure. We have a number of patients who are out over a decade with an allotransplant. Now, I would not rush to do allotransplants because of the graft versus host disease morbidity, and we've had some mortality as well.
How about your 65-year-old man?
So this is a very interesting man, a lovely man who was both a scholar and a minister. He has a systemic cytotoxic T-cell lymphoma that involved the skin, the lung, lymph nodes, and marrow.
When you say systemic cytotoxic T-cell lymphoma, what do you mean?
So there are markers that are associated with cytotoxic T cells, TIA, granzyme. They're also CD8 positive, as his was, not CD4 positive, like mycosis fungoides and Sézary syndrome. And when he first presented, he was symptomatic. It was rapidly progressive. He had indurated plaques, small tumor lesions, didn't feel well, low-grade fevers, cough. And we treated him with a regimen that's referred to as CMED, because we know historically CHOP chemotherapy was not particularly effective. CMED stands for Cytoxan, which is moderately high dose, 2,000 milligrams per meter square. Then there is methotrexate, again at a moderate dose. I think it's 400 milligrams per meter square. Patients also get etoposide and dexamethasone. And this is given over a course of 6 cycles. It was actually developed by investigators in Mexico. And there's been some discussion whether or not a publication suggesting an advantage to this over CHOP was truly a randomized trial. That's how it had been presented in one of the publications. But needless to say, I've used it a few times with some significant responses, and they seem to be durable. Because of his age and because of the results that had been reported by the group from Mexico, we decided to just observe him. And he is still in remission since the initiation of therapy, which happened in June of 2008. So we'll have to see how durable it will be. Had we not use CMED, if I used CHOP alone, I probably would have considered an autologous transplant right after the initiation of therapy.
Actually, I was going to ask you, has pralatrexate been integrated into combinations like this, replacing the methotrexate?
As far as I know, pralatrexate has only been used to date in patients who had failed previous chemotherapy. My anticipation is going to be used in a spectrum of combination regimens. Having said that, there may be some isolated trials that have already been initiated where it's been combined with other agents like gemcitabine, which is a popular agent in the T-cell lymphomas.
And again, what are you thinking in terms of this man's future?
I would be shocked if he stays in a complete remission on an indefinite basis. I'd be ecstatic. We're prepared to retreat him and do an autologous transplant or proceed to an allo because he has a donor, and that decision would occur if he were to relapse.
When you do use transplant in these patients, what do you see in terms of response?
When transplant has been incorporated in patients who respond to initial chemotherapy, not so much for the cytotoxic, there's not enough data on that, there's such a rare entity, but more with the peripheral T-cell lymphomas, the 5-year survival rates start to become more encouraging, still less than 50%. The dilemma is that there's clearly a selection bias, and there has never been a randomized trial of traditional aggressive chemotherapy versus chemotherapy followed by autologous transplant to know the true advantage.
How about your 75-year-old man with mycosis fungoides?
So the 75-year-old man presented with extensive patch plaque disease. We call it stage 1B. He was, again, a laborer, lives in Chicago. He had elements of large cell transformation in the mycosis fungoides on the recent biopsies, but originally was very classic. He had some significant comorbidities, COPD, and congestive heart failure. His original diagnosis was in 2001, so again, he's been through a whole spectrum of treatments, including topical nitrogen mustard, PUVA plus interferon, PUVA plus low-dose bexarotene, all of which gave him substantial benefit for a period of months to over a year, had spot radiation to some isolated lesions that were troubling, had a remarkable 2-year response to gemcitabine, which is one of the more effective drugs and well-tolerated. It doesn't cause hair loss, doesn't usually cause significant nausea and vomiting. I tend to use it as 1,000 milligrams per meter square every 2 weeks rather than pushing the dose as you may in other diseases. He then had traditional Cytoxan, vincristine, prednisone, and methotrexate, both of which had modest results. And then, interestingly enough, in spite of the modest results with methotrexate, which I believe he was getting at about 12.5 milligrams per week, and he's a slight man, when he progressed on the methotrexate, folitin became approved, pralatrexate. And so he went on folitin at a slightly reduced dose after discussions with a local oncologist who's providing the treatment because he doesn't live that close to Northwestern. And I got a note saying that he's had a very nice partial response already, although the treatment was complicated by 2-plus mucositis and had to be delayed for one cycle.
Any theme to these patients and to this patient group in general?
Theme is the fact that the disease tends to be recalcitrant. You tend to get responses, then it comes back. That's one theme. The second theme is that clearly for the cutaneous lymphomas, there is a graft versus leukemia or lymphoma effect when you do allotransplants, because we find that after allotransplants, sometimes when we're withdrawing Well, when we have the patients on immunosuppression, we see the disease starting to reappear, and then when we withdraw immunosuppression, we see again the disease enter a remission.